And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And now we're going to get into this evening's commentary. This evening's commentary is from Oak. Oak has been sending us commentary for many years now, and this one's entitled...
Conservatives Who Don't Conserve. It seems as if nothing is sacred for today's so-called conservatives. The very root of their philosophy is utterly ignored as right-wing politicians, pundits, and their corporate sponsors hack their way blindly across the political landscape and the planet. Their true conservative predecessors must be rolling in their graves. George W. Bush, like his father before him, is all about big oil. His energy policy is not even a thinly veiled version of old Republican energy policies. It reflects the supply-side thinking that has dominated right-wing circles for decades. More is the motto, as Bush, his corporate handlers, and legions of their automatons crank up the thermostat, oblivious to the winter wind howling through the open door. That's Congressman Bernie Sanders' North Country metaphor, one he used to blast the Bush administration for its short-sighted energy policy that places no emphasis, to speak of, on energy conservation. It's an apt metaphor for people who have lost sight of reality and whose attachment to the planet and their fellow inhabitants seems all but lost. In a nation that consumes 30% of the world's resources with only 5% of the world's population, it's actually criminal to ignore conservation. And, quite frankly, that is how we are viewed by most of the other 95%. The United States is the real evil empire, the nation where the laws of thermodynamics are ignored, an outlaw nation. Corporate America and their cronies in government squander the gifts of the planet, letting much of it fall to the wayside, unused and irretrievable. And these people call themselves conservatives? They conserve only their own privilege in a world running short on ecological options. A true conservative knows the value of conservation. A true conservative practices thrift, using whatever resources they require with care and foresight, keeping future generations in mind. Does that sound like the present occupant of the White House? Is that the mentality guiding proponents of corporate globalism as they seek to undo environmental safeguards, claiming them as restraints against fair trade? Is that the thinking behind an industrial assault upon the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or a renewal of the ill-conceived nuclear power industry? We don't think so. Actually, the Democrats' counter-energy plan reads more like a conservatives' idea of energy policy. This is not surprising, given how far to the right the Democrats have wandered. Why don't they simply skip the pretense and claim the mantle of conservatism for themselves? That done, the denizens of the far right can be pegged for what they truly are, enemies of the earth and its inhabitants, former conservatives who have gone over to the dark side. At least that's how this Oak sees it for Earth First Radio.
Our good friends here at the Plum Creek Timber Company have been cutting our Lewis and Clark Trail. They've just been cutting alongside, you know, nothing big, nothing like we can show our kids like later on. You know, it's like, oh, look, big desert. Oh, here's a tree. Yeah, it's quite amazing. So check this out. The story's from the Associated Press. Plum Creek Timber Company refused to sell a section of land along the Lewis and Clark Trail to the United States Forest Service. Instead, selling the government a 15-foot easement allowing public access and then clear-cutting the property. They probably left the trees on that easement. Critics say the total logging of the Lodgepole Pine Forest sheltering, a portion of the famous trail near Lolo Pass, stripped the land of its historic setting. It occurred at a time when the national spotlight is beginning to shine on the trail that gave the Lewis and Clark expedition passage through the Bitterroot Mountains in 1805 and 1806. Yeehaw! For centuries, Salish Indians traveled west over the trail to dig camas root at Lolo Pass and fish for salmon and steelhead on the Clearwater and Snake Rivers. And from the plateaus of central Idaho, the Nez Perce tribe used the trail to travel east onto the plains to hunt buffalo. It is almost inconceivable that Plum Creek could have undertaken this project knowing the bicentennial was ahead, said Gene Thompson, a forestry technician who oversees trail maintenance for Lolo National Forest. That's what saddens me. This is the first time the trail has had so much attention focused on it. By all have seen the section as it appeared 18 months ago. Oh, pardon me. By all indications, a lot of people will come over this trail in the next few years. I just wish they, trail visitors, could have seen this section as it appeared 18 months ago. This was a place where you could really understand the trails of the Native Americans and trails of Lewis and Clark when they encountered these mountains. Forest archaeologist Milo McLeod said the historic tread remains, but the integrity of the setting has been lost forever. It is unfortunate that Plum Creek could not have been more sensitive to the value of the historic setting. The Lee Creek area was the largest piece of intact forest on the Montana portion of the Lolo Trail, Thompson said. Now the edge of the national forest is marked by the line of 90-year-old lodgepole pines, their sides painted red to show the change in ownership. Cross into the national forest and the scene is dark, cool, and green. Turn around and traverse the adjoining Plum Creek section and the mountainside is open, almost bare, with only growth at ground level where foresters planted new trees. Jerry Sorensen, a land use manager for Plum Creek, told the Missoulian during an interview that he has not seen the clear-cut site at Lee Creek. But less than a month ago, during a ceremony commemorating signing of the public easement, the 15-foot easement that is, Sorensen said, "My company and predecessors have managed this area for many decades as part of our working forest, and for as long a time. We have recognized the special importance of this area and have protected the integrity and character of the Lolo Trail." Asked the Missoulian reporter to elaborate, Sorensen said on Friday that the Forest Service bought an easement, not the land, in Lee Creek, and Plum Creek never hid the fact the timber would all be harvested. "Our foresters felt this was the best way to manage the ground for the long term, not just for the 2 years of the Lewis and Clark celebration," said Plum Creek spokeswoman Chris Russell. "We are looking at the forest over decades, not over a couple of years. This open hillside below Wagon Mountain has not lost its forest," Russell insisted. "This is a forest. It is just a very, 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 very young forest," she said, referring to the growing seedlings. Lolo National Forest Supervisor Debbie Austin said she was not surprised when her staff reported the land had been logged during the 2 years she was negotiating the easement with Plum Creek. "There were some expectations that some people had, and those people were quite surprised when this happened," she said. "I was not. Plum Creek agreed to sell portions of land containing the Lolo Trail, but they were not willing to sell Section 1, Austin said, of the Lee Creek area. "They were willing to give us public access by way of an easement, and that was what we purchased. I always knew the management would be different in Section 1. All we acquired was a 15-foot trail easement." During negotiations, Austin said she asked Plum Creek foresters if they could take a lighter torch in managing the forest alongside the historic trail. "But they told me they would be managing this land, and they wanted to manage the trees. At that point in the negotiations, my choice was to protect the trail tread and public access, or to walk away. I felt the trail was more important than walking away. The Forest Service paid $4,600 for trail easements on two sections of Plum Creek land, one of which was recently clear-cut Lee Creek section. Russell said her company does not sell timberland, that we think we can manage well for long-term forestry. A clear-cut was the right forestry prescription for the lodgepole trees in Lee Creek, Russell said. We did what was right for the ground. I do not feel it diminishes the trail or its importance or the easement of its importance. The easement is in perpetuity, as is the forest. Forest Service officials did not disagree with Russell's assessment. This is private land, Thompson said. What was done here was within the legal rights and responsibilities of the landowner. Archaeologist McLeod agreed the company was within its own rights to cut limber, but he believes the corporation could have been more sensitive. They could have left a corridor. The trail first was named a National Historic Landmark and then placed on the National Historic Register. This is a place significant to our nation's history, but it is also an industrial forest, McLeod said. The 120-mile route from Lolo, south of Missoula, Waiapi, Idaho, is a priceless historic artifact, McLeod said, and we thank the Associated Press.
Orcas are in trouble. PCPs and fewer salmon could explain the decline in killer whale populations in the story by Lee Dye. How appropriate a name it is. Who writes for abcnews.com. When you see them in the wild, they look indestructible. A male orca can weigh up to 11,000 pounds, and they have been known to eat just about everything from fish to other whales. So with the abundance of the sea at their disposal, killer whales, which are actually more akin to dolphins than to other whales, would seem to have little to fear, except perhaps the one creature it's never been known to feed on, that's humans. The fact is the water's getting a little rough for the killer whale, which is found in every sea from the Arctic to the Antarctic. And in one area, Washington State's southern Puget Sound, the resident population of orcas has dropped 20% over the past 5 years, prompting the federal government to consider adding it to the endangered species list. Scientists say no one knows for sure just what's going on with the three pods of orcas that make up that population, but the number of animals has dropped from 97 to 78 in just 5 years, and 7 were lost last year alone. What's really worrisome is that we're losing what we're supposed to be the healthiest animals, said Stephanie Hawks Johnson, a doctoral candidate in animal behavior at the University of Washington, who is heading up a multi-year effort to find out what is killing off the whales. It isn't just that the old folks are dying off, she says. It's the younger ones in their early 20s at the height of their reproductive capability that are disappearing. That doesn't mean the killer whales as a species is dying out, but the fact that three pods in one area are in so much trouble is of great concern to whale experts. One of the pods has not produced a calf since 1996. Although the exact cause is still a mystery, the evidence at hand suggests that a number of factors are contributing to the biological domino effect. Primary suspects are declining salmon runs, a preferred diet of these particular orcas, and poison from a number of industrial compounds that have been banned for years. A particular concern are polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCPs, and the pesticide DDT. The National Marine Fisheries Service reported recently that these banned substances are found in juvenile salmon studied for over the past 3 years. Concentrations were high enough to damage fish immune systems, the agency says, and that toxicity could be passed up the food chain to other creatures, including orcas that eat the salmon. The agency also says it isn't clear whether the chemicals can also be harmful to humans who eat contaminated fish. But that's just part of the problem, Hawks Johnson says. She took a break from her graduate studies to work as a naturalist on a tour boat operated by a company called the Mosquito Fleet over the past few years, and that gave her plenty of chances to observe the orca's lifestyle. Common sense tells me what's going on, she says. These animals don't have enough food. Salmon runs have declined in most areas and died out completely in others, and that has forced the whales to look elsewhere for food. What she suspects is that they are finding it in the wrong place, at the bottom of the sea. If there aren't enough salmon to go around, the whales are probably eating a lot more bottom fish, which tend to have even higher concentrations of PCBs, she says. It also requires a greater expenditure of energy to dive to the depths where those bottom fish are found, and this pumps up the demand for food. A mature orca can require 300 pounds of food per day, and it appears the whales aren't finding enough salmon, so they are being forced to dive for less satisfying food and getting loaded with toxic chemicals. They're getting hit with a triple whammy, she says. Much of the evidence for that comes from an autopsy on a dead orca found in March of last year. It had quite a story to tell. He was a 22-year-old male, and his body was ravaged by bacterial infection that he should have been able to fight off, she says. It just completely got into every organ in his body and killed him. Scientists think toxic chemicals did so much damage to the whale's immune system that it simply couldn't fight back what probably started out as a common cold. Unfortunately, that's the only dead orca that has been found, she says, leaving scientists in the uncomfortable position of relying on a sample size of one. It might seem that the dead whale should be a pretty easy thing to find, but the fact is, they don't just float up, Johnson says. The orcas of the Pacific Northwest are so closely monitored that if a missing whale turned up in the wrong pod, it would be immediately identified. The whales that are missing from the southern Puget Sound pods have never turned up anywhere else, according to professional whale watchers, so they are presumed dead. The new study launched by the University of Washington will seek to fill in some of the many gaps in what we know about the behavior of killer whales. Scientists will track the whales with a 6-foot-long radio-controlled catamaran that is equipped with a fish finder that should tell if the whales are indeed getting most of their food from the bottom of the sea. That will be useful along the coast of Washington, where the whales go somewhere else during, but the whales go somewhere else during the winter, and no one is certain where. Perhaps the most serious problem is what is happening offshore in the winter, says David Bain, an animal behaviorist who has studied orcas for 20 years. He dreams of building a robotic vessel that could follow the whales throughout the year. In the meantime, scientists will rely on a tiny but well-endowed catamaran to peer below the surface and eavesdrop on some of the most magnificent animals that are in a great deal of trouble. And here's the story of cows dropping poisonous poop, the story of the everlasting cow pie. Scientists gathered in the French Alps to discuss a complex problem of poisonous and everlasting cow pies. The cause of the problem is believed to be a medicine called ivermectin, which is given to cows, sheep, and horses before they go to summer pasture in the Alps. This medicine, which protects the animals from parasites, has made their dung toxic and virtually indestructible. Insects that feed on the droppings are dying, threatening the survival of birds and bats that eat those insects. A single cow pie or cow pat left by an animal treated by ivermectin is capable of killing up to 20,000 dung-eating insects a week. A cow produces about 12 cow pies a day, said Professor Jean-Pierre Lumeret of the University of Montpellier. If the dung does not decompose, it becomes like a stone which stops the grass from growing. In the Mediterranean area, we have seen cow pies from treated animals survive for 4 or more years. The aim of the conference in Isère, southeast France, is to persuade farmers and veterinarians to use another kind of treatment, and we want to thank the San Francisco Chronicle for that story. What have you got for us next there, Jason?
All right, we got a winner here. Check this out. This is great for our animal front. These liberation cats are the bomb. But check this out. They'll dig this story. National agreement reached to protect 29 imperiled species and many critical habitat areas. On 8/28/2G1, the Center for Biological Diversity, Southern Appalachian Biodiversity Project, and the California Native Plant Society reached an agreement in principle with the United States Fish and Wildlife Service to help expedite the protection of 29 species and numerous critical habitat areas under the Endangered Species Act. The species span much of the United States, from the Marina Islands, California, and Washington State, to Missouri, North Carolina, and Florida. Under the agreement, the Fish and Wildlife Service will be given extra time to complete 8 court-ordered critical habitat decisions. It will use funds temporarily freed up by the extension to issue a rapid series of emergency, final, proposed, and initial listing decisions for the 29 species. Many of the decisions will include critical habitat designations. Among the species which will be protected are Washington's pygmy rabbit, which has been reduced to just 50 individual rabbits, the Mississippi gopher frog, which lives in a single pond threatened by development, the coastal cutthroat trout in southwest Washington and northern Oregon, 6 California species including the island fox, mountain yellow-legged frog, and Carson wandering skipper butterfly. 6 southwestern species include the Gila chub and Chiricahua leopard frog, 3 Utah species including the Bonneville cutthroat trout, Missouri's Tumbling Creek cave snail, and the Miami blue butterfly. For maps, species profiles, and other information on the agreement, grab your pen, because here we go. It's www.biologicaldiversity.org/, this is a long one, SWCBD/activist/ESA, GunsNRoses/settlement.html. Real quick, that's www.biologicaldiversity.org.
And they can find their way from there.
Yeah. And also, Also, for those at home interested in how you can help stuff out locally, check out your local SPCA. They're great, and they need a lot of animals. Go adopt an old dog. I'm actually thinking of that. I don't know, but we'll see what happens. It's pretty cool.
Anyway, that's all the time we have for Earth First Radio News tonight. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzeef@cruzio.com. That's cruzeef@cruzio.com. And we thank CruzIO for sponsoring us for these so many years. You can also send snail mail to Earth First Radio at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please send all announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Tuesday night at, that's Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific time. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. And listen in. There's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz, so listen in anytime. You can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net, and search for Earth First Radio. This is show number 160. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, and we want to thank Jason for his help tonight. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening in. And now we're going to listen to some Robert Earl Keane. This one's called Armadillo Jackal.
Sun was singing down, a chill north wind it blows. The new plowed ground was cooling fast, the river rolls and flows. Beneath the two-lane concrete river bridge, between my place and town, on that hotbed farm to market road they call 1291. I'm saying, son, you'll see me searching, sizzling down that broad highway. Dollar signs in both my eyes, I'm seeking out my prey. I'm praying, Jesus, will you send me just another three or four? They pay $2.50 down in Hallettsville, $3, maybe more. And more than likely they'll be out tonight, wandering from the farm, waddling down 1291 to keep their bodies warm. I'm talking walking belts and neckties and boots for rodeo. They don't run too fast, don't waste much gas. I'm making lots of dough. The armadillo, the armadillo, oh, the armadillo never sees me when I hit him with my brights. His life don't pass before his eyes, he's blinded by my lights. And so I hit him with my bumper, doing 60, 65. They take him frozen down in Hallettsville, they don't take him alive. The jackal cried, the jackal cried,
the jackal cried, but there's two of them walking down the line. I can't believe my luck tonight, this year makes 29. And so he rode the first one running, the second was too fast. His brakes and laughter squealing as he stomped down on the gas. Good God, his car was sideways flying when the bridge walk met his door. The impact shook the river bed, his foot went through the floor forevermore. Was his last moment. From the bridge walk to the stream, from the speckled blood around his smile to spewing gasoline. And then he screamed his raspy epitaph. Before he turned to flame, they pay $2.50 down in Howardsville. I ain't the one to blame. Ain't it a shame? The jackal cried. Ah, the armadillo. Oh, the armadillo. Oh, the armadillo. Oh, the armadillo.
Oh, the armadillo. We've always had the science on our side. That is a fact not easily denied. They can play their petty games and call us nasty names, but we've always had the science on our side. There's those of them who call our science junk. But let me tell you, that's a lot of bunk. Their argument's so weak, they have to scream, not speak. And we've always had the science on our side. There's other ones who call our science weird. They're the weird ones, and not to be feared. For in the light of day, they simply melt away. And we've always had the science on our side. We've always had the science on our side. That's a source of our power and our pride. For though the truth they flout, they cannot put it out. And we've always had the science on our side. I am a tree. I have lived on the mountain a long time. I have seen snow, rain, wind. I have weathered them all. I am only afraid of fire. My grandfather died in a great fire 900 years ago. My father fell in a windstorm. Without it, I might never have been born. I am approaching 300 years of age. The eagles call me beautiful as I top the forest canopy. I'm afraid only of fire. Yet I know that death by fire perpetuates my kind. I know that the forest and the mountain depend on fire. We are a community. Forest, fire, and mountain. We three. Though I fear fire, I embrace it. I embrace its heat that will render me to ash, that will turn me into nutrients for the next generation, even as it unlocks the mystery of life in the seeds I scatter promiscuously below me. The snows are crystalline and beautiful. The rain and winds that make my branches shake, I welcome. But what I fear and what I love is fire.